Hey, I'm Celia, and welcome to our Women in Science series for Women's History Month. Join us as we hear from women making great strides in their fields, from reproductive health to animal evolution. We'll learn about the challenges they've faced in their journey, as well as what can be done to improve their representation, and how bringing women into leadership positions will allow them to lift up others. For the fourth episode of this series, I spoke to Dr. Flora Rutaganira, a postdoctoral researcher at UC Berkeley and an HHMI Hannah Gray Fellow. She recently got her PhD in chemical biology from UCSF, and she studies these adorable animal-adjacent critters called coanoflagellates. We talked a ton about them, as well as what makes biochemistry so exciting, how she's found community as a postdoc, and some of the institutional challenges faced by marginalized early career researchers. Enjoy.
This
is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
All right. Hi, my name is Flora, and I'm a postdoc researcher here at Berkeley, and I'm using chemistry to study some very interesting organisms called coanoflagellates. They are very interesting because they're the closest living relatives to animals. We don't have a fossil record for the earliest animals, which existed about 600 million years ago. So we use coanoflagellates as a tool to study what early animals may have looked like and what they may have acted like.
Very stupid question, but what defines an animal?
Right, yeah, so animals are these groups of organisms that are characterized by their multicellular aspect, and so all animals have multiple types of cells that work together and function as an organism. And these coanoflagellates have this interesting transition between unicellular life and multicellular life that we think is very reminiscent to this transition from unicellular organisms that transitioned into animals, which are multicellular.
What got you interested in this specific line of work? So this is what you're doing as a postdoc right now. Is this the same thing that you were doing before?
No, so this is completely different from me. I was trained mostly as a chemist. In graduate school, I worked in Kayvon Shokat's lab, and they study a lot of different things. The main focus of my research in Kayvon's lab was studying this specific class of proteins called kinases.
So super quick for the non-biochemists among us, kinases are proteins whose job is to modify other proteins by adding phosphate groups to them. That process, called phosphorylation, changes the charge and bulk of the protein, which alters their activity.
They're very important for various human disease research. So a lot of current cancer therapy is directed towards inhibiting or reducing the activity of these kinases. And so I developed some tools, chemical tools, to study these kinases within a biological context. But while developing those tools, I got very interested in kind of the ancient functions of what these kinases would do. So we know that they're important for human health and other higher order animals, but we didn't necessarily know how they came about to be what they're like now. So looking at coanoflagellates was really interesting to me because we start to see a lot of the kinases that we find very important in humans present in coanoflagellates. But we don't know what their function is in coanoflagellates. Obviously, as a very simplistic organism, they might have different functions completely from animals, but they might also have some functions that are reminiscent to animal complexity. Physically looking at these coanoflagellates, some things that might be reminiscent are they look a lot like sperm cells. And so they are characterized by this bowl-shaped body that has this collar and the flagella, and they eat bacteria. And so they use this collar to kind of help. You can think of it as a little cage, open cage, that they use to like collect bacteria and swim around with a flagella.
Cute.
And so their food system is very simple compared to us, but by body plan, they look very reminiscent to, as I said, like a sperm cell.
Okay, so you're studying coanoflagellates now, and this is like slightly different from what you were studying as a graduate student coming from chemistry.
Uh-huh.
Did you always think that you wanted to go into science, or did it take you by surprise?
So I immigrated to the United States when I was three with my parents. I was born in Rwanda, and we left Rwanda because it was right about the time during the Rwandese genocide. We were lucky in that my dad was able to get a Guggenheim Fellowship, and he got his PhD actually at UC Davis in mathematics. And so I grew up you know, familiar with the idea of science. My mom is also currently and was then also as well a lab manager and staff scientist at UC Davis in the pomology department, then called pomology. Now it's post-harvest. They basically study what happens to fruits after you harvest them. So they come up with various treatments and ways to get rid of pests. Cool. I always kind of was surrounded with this idea of science. It kind of spans two different ways, right? My dad was a mathematician, so that was very abstract to me. And then there was my mom's side, which was very practical science, right? But there wasn't really anything in between. So I kind of had this vague notion of science is fun. I also grew up around university students and their kids because we grew up in student housing. Yeah, again, this idea of science was always around, but actually physically doing the science wasn't something that I thought of really until I got into high school. In high school, chemistry, Mrs. Sharon, she was like jumping up and down when people would get experiments right. And if they didn't get it right, she's like, oh, let's figure out how we can like work this out. And it really, yeah, it caught my attention and it was a lot of fun. And I feel like I was very lucky to have that experience because often people, you know, have really crappy experiences with science. It's all about taking the test. It's all about passing a test. And you miss out on all of this excitement that that goes along with the process of doing science. And also at UC Davis, I feel like it was I went to UC Davis to get my bachelor's degree in biochemistry, and just the breadth of types of science going on. I feel like that was when I realized like, wow, like people are literally studying everything. And that was a great thing because I was like, wow, there's so many options, and also terrible because I was like, wow, I want to study everything, which is not possible.
Right. So then when you're looking at this vast world of science, like, oh my God, I want to study everything. What made you settle on biochemistry in the end?
Yeah. I'd originally chosen the major because it was super broad on purpose, just in case I changed my mind.
Right. It's like, oh, it's biology and yeah, chemistry. Yeah, exactly. I can have it all. What do you think is the most exciting thing about biochemistry?
You know, right now is a great time to be doing biochemistry because we've gotten to take advantage of a lot of the recent advances in genome sequencing. I feel like we had big ideas of what these proteins were, but couldn't really devise ways to actually study them or know like what their sequences were, et cetera. And so now with molecular biology techniques and genome sequencing, you know, we have this access to like a wide vast amount of proteins that are able to be studied. And so I feel like almost my world of biochemistry is similar to the world of science now, in that like there are so many different things that can possibly be studied. And that's very exciting to me.
Now that you are a postdoc, do you have a specific kind of like academic trajectory in mind, or are you still in the process of figuring that out?
Yeah, so I do want to become a faculty member. I'm currently trying to figure out like what my lab specifically would do. I spent time at UCSF working on research that was directed towards human health and developing a lot of tools to study these kinases that were important in the context of human health. But I think there's a lot to be gained, again, in addition to this recent era of genome sequencing, and to move the tools that we are using to study human health to also move it to study a bunch of different things, like including other animals, including these coanoflagellates. There's a lot of biochemistry and biology to be discovered, and I feel like we are now at a great time to marry the two things, or, you know, use these tools that we've developed for human health in other contexts to study, for example, what are the ancient functions of kinases? What are the ancient functions of other proteins? And I think by doing that, we can discover why either certain animals or the closest living relatives to animals are interesting in their own right, and then also potentially inform how we can develop second generation tools to study human health even better.
And like, what are some of the challenges that come up when you are in this early postdoc stage of your career? Because I imagine that the challenge of like, I need to figure out what my future lab is going to be is, I mean, I'm trying to picture that. I'm like, I don't know what I would do. Yeah, I guess like what like unique career challenges and opportunities present themselves as a postdoc?
So I was super fortunate to get this fellowship, the Hannah Gray Fellowship from HHMI that was recently brought out. That fellowship has given me a lot of flexibility just to study what I'm the most interested in. And so I've been spending my time really trying to think hard about what science captivates me and what type of science I'm enthusiastic about further studying and communicating. And so I've kind of taken that approach. And as I mentioned, I'm excited about science and research in general. And so it's been a bit difficult for me to like really focus and narrow down on what I'm most interested in. The grand idea of the lab kind of changes a little bit every quarter or so. And yeah, I agree. It's a really hard challenge to think about what you're going to be doing potentially for the next however many years.
Maybe forever.
But I'm also very flexible and open to change. And so I'm okay with saying, you know, if I can think 10 years down the road, this is something that I'm going to be interested in doing versus saying, you know, maybe 30 years down the road, what am I going to be working on?
Before becoming a postdoc, while she was still a grad student, Flora co-started Scientists for Diversity at UCSF.
We started that organization because we wanted to bring graduate students that were from the different programs together to talk about issues of diversity and retention, and then also just give a space for people to have fun. And so that was super important for me in graduate school, because I felt like after your first year especially, people just spend time with their lab and they don't really talk to other people. You know, people just kind of get left behind because they're just mainly working with their labs. And if you have a great lab, that's awesome. I was fortunate to have an amazing lab, so I enjoyed interacting with my lab mates. But there were also people that needed an additional outlet to talk to other people, especially when it came to issues of diversity. And so starting this organization was great because we were able, again, to bring these different graduate students together. We were able to interact with younger faculty that had been recruited to UCSF, which I feel is super important. Oftentimes, we were talking to tenured faculty members. Their time from graduate school has been so long ago that like they can't even really relate often to like what the current graduate school experience is. And so talking to these early career faculty members was great.
This kind of relates to something I was hoping to ask you about anyway. So the sense that I've gotten also as an academic is that, you know, like there are organizations that exist, especially at the level of being an undergrad or a grad student, for you to interact with people who share your identity. And then I feel like that all just drops out when you become a postdoc.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, like, as a postdoc, kind of separated from these resources, where do you find community?
I agree. It totally drops off. And I think some of it is because, you know, postdocs are really, really focused on getting project done and then transitioning to their next career stage. And I think another part is that, you know, people are becoming more cognizant of, you know, work-life balance. And so I think as postdocs, some people also tend to just take more time for themselves. But I agree, there is definitely space to kind of, you know, rethink how postdocs are integrated in the university system and how, especially to connect them to graduate students.
Like, obviously, a major issue in science is both encouraging the participation and the retention mm-hmm. of women and people of color and queer folks and et cetera. Are there specific things that you think that institutions should be doing to improve those numbers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done from like a more institutional paperwork level all the way down. I feel like at the very basic level, just recognizing that there needs to be space for people to meet and providing opportunities for people to do that, letting grad students and postdocs and even undergraduates know that there are rooms available that they can book themselves and they can set up meetings, and providing staff support for ensuring that that space is always available, I think is super important. When it comes to issues of retention, I think there's a delicate balance with recognizing that some early career faculty especially would be really nice to talk to, but they also need time to establish themselves as faculty members, right? And then there's also issues with their own retention. And so I think it is a very delicate balance between recognizing that the people that want to be retained are often putting out most of the effort to ensure that they're retained, I think is a problem. And I mean, obviously I fell into that category and I created a student group because I was like, something needs to be done. And there's something to be said that when people do that, that those groups function better, potentially because the students that are creating those organizations know what their needs are. But it was nice to know when I was doing that, that there was, for example, student government was able to give us money so that we could provide food to have at meetings. It was nice to know that there were always rooms available that we could book consistently to have meetings. And even more important now that the graduate division would, you know, post on social media or various university press that, you know, these groups existed and, you know, they were excited to talk to this faculty member that was coming to visit at a seminar. And then also just providing space to have awards, et cetera, to recognize people that have gone out of their way to ensure that, you know, there are spaces for people within these marginalized groups to develop community and talk to each other. Yeah. I feel like talking about what can a university do to make things better is just a crazy big conversation.
Oh yeah, that could be a whole separate thing. Not to continue burrowing down this rabbit hole too far, because you mentioned that there are some like big like institutional paperwork level changes that could happen. Can you maybe give one or two examples of that?
Yeah. More recent trends that have gotten, you know, more moving towards a positive direction are recognizing that sexual harassment happens and providing outlets for people to talk about and just put it out in the open, that it is a concern that a lot of individuals are sexually harassed, for one, and that there are institutional policies that deal with what happens afterwards and making it super obvious to people what to do, how to approach the topic, so that it doesn't fall on the people that have had this situation having to go and explain to everybody else, you know, what needs to happen. I feel like that's probably the most concrete thing that I've seen recently. Transparency is one huge thing. At UCSF, one thing that Black students always talked about, they were like, where is everyone? Like, and we had no numbers, really. And so it was hard to make other people aware that this was a problem when there weren't numbers to like back it. Like you felt it as a student.
Right. You're like, where's the data?
Where's the data? Yeah. And like, it's been nice to see that things like sexual harassment, like retention of marginalized groups have been approached with similar ways that we're approaching our science, which is with rigorous data. And that data is presented and communicated and it's done in a safe way where people can, you know, respond to it.
Is there something that you wish that you had known at an earlier stage of your career?
So I guess if I was thinking to former me, like definitely don't be afraid to reach out to people within your university that you don't see on a regular basis to talk about hard questions, because they probably have some insight that you don't have. But it's super intimidating, I agree, to send that email and be like, hi, I am one of 30,000 students. Like, can you take some time, you know, to chat with me about why I need to do research and how to even go about doing that? Well, now there's like this whole social media thing that like didn't even exist when I was an undergrad. So I guess if I was going to do different things differently now and I had access to Twitter and stuff, I would be reaching out to people even outside of my university and talking to them about why they got into science. I participated in a program called the Biology Undergraduate Scholars Program at UC Davis, which was great. That was super beneficial because it was something I could put on my resume and say, oh, I was in this program, and oh, I got a little research grant, and I got to present my work. That was something that maybe not the typical student did that I was, you know, happy to have access to. And during my time there, the Undergrad Research Center also started a one-day conference for anyone to sign up throughout the university as an undergraduate to present their research to the wider community, which I thought was amazing because, you know, science communication started early as an undergraduate. And it was really hard to talk about my research, which I knew very little about, you know, to faculty members that were coming by a poster. But it at least challenged me to start thinking about how do I talk about science at different levels, like thinking about how you speak to a second grader versus how you speak to someone that's a tenured faculty member about what excites you and or how do you interpret your data. I'm glad I participated in those things, but I almost wish I kind of did it maybe a little bit earlier.
Going back even further, if you were talking to, say, like a seventh grader about why she should go into science, like what would you say?
So when I talk to either elementary or junior high students, I usually ask them like, what excites them the most about science and what makes them nervous about doing science? I feel like there's usually either they don't feel like they're smart enough. For some students, and maybe a little bit for me even, I didn't see a lot of women in science. And so I was like, well, that's weird. Maybe there's something that I'm not noticing, right? That's wrong about that. And so giving those types of students exposure to people that look like them, I think is super important. And encouraging them to reach out to people that are in science is also really important.
I remember being in high school and taking AP Physics or something, and there were like three girls in that class. But I remembered thinking like, good, because girls are stupid. And so if I'm the only girl in this class, it must mean it's a smart people class because there's only boys in it.
Yeah.
Did you ever have thoughts like that?
So I went to an all-girls high school. So I feel like I had, this is why I also semi struggle with the question of how do you encourage women to go in science? Because like literally there were all women encouraged to go into science. And so like, I feel like it's semi unfair in that way. Yeah. And biology in itself, I feel like it's 50-50 in a sense almost.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
It drops off definitely after you get past the undergraduate level, but I don't remember any extreme cases in my science classes as an undergraduate. But my sister's a computer scientist, and so she has a very different story. And yeah, she has often told me, yeah, I'm one of 3-4 women in the class. And I mean, it comes with its own challenges, but yeah, she's very much the fighter. And so I feel like, you know, she also has that approach, like, great, that means that, like, when I accomplish this, it's going to mean even more because I'm a woman doing this. Yeah.
Was there ever a time when you thought that you wanted to leave science?
I can't say that there was ever a time that I wanted to fully leave science. There was definitely times where I felt like I wasn't sure if I wanted to be on the track to be a faculty member, for sure. And that came with its own struggles of, like, how do I know what I'm excited about actually is interesting to anyone else but me? Like, how am I going to get this stuff funded? Like, all of those questions. But I've always been interested in doing science in some way. And a part of that, I feel like, also is because I did go to a graduate program that embraced careers outside of the traditional science, which I hate that they're called alternative careers. But let's not talk about that.
Right, that also could be an entirely separate podcast episode.
But, I mean, I always was excited about science, and I always felt like there was a way for me to do something involved with science. Even if it was, like, the worst day in lab, I would still be comfortable communicating science. And so there was always ways to think about doing that outside from physically being within a lab pipetting. Grad school definitely had its times where it was hard. Thankfully, I had mentors that were able to, like, support me and get me through it and encourage me and reassure me that I was not the only one that felt like they were an absolute failure and that they had experienced it too. I think that was super refreshing. And I'm super fortunate and privileged to have had the opportunity to be surrounded by people that were such great mentors. I also was able to find them pretty easily, which I feel like is also another struggle is, you know, oftentimes those people don't present themselves and you have to take a lot of personal effort to find them.
What? Grad school is hard. Gasp, a shocker. What is your favorite thing about your current job?
Quinoflagellates in themselves are, like, they're beautiful. I think that they're absolutely beautiful. Looking at them under the microscope, I don't know. It, like, evokes very strange emotions that I didn't think I was going to have.
Wait, like what?
Like, you think they're cute and, like, right, and they're, like, the closest living relatives to animals, right? So they're not really, like, dog cute, but for some weird reason, I'm like, oh, look at them swimming around in the flask. And then when I treat them with various drugs, I'm like, oh, no, sad day. Which I think is very strange. What excites me the most is that there's just so much unlearned biology, right? There's just so much we don't know, and it's really exciting being able to be in a field where you're discovering new biology, you know, as you go almost every day, which is crazy to me. I feel like when I was, you know, working on questions in human health, not that they were harder questions, but it seems like the barrier to getting something that was unique was a really, really big, hard thing. And so it's been refreshing going to a system that's definitely less studied and presents its own unique opportunities to discover biology in a way that can be translated to the human health or whatever level that's higher.
So Flora loves coanoflagellates, and the more that I learned about them, the more that I understood why.
Coanoflagellates are able to have this contractile phenotype that we haven't seen. So think about a bunch of different cells coming together and then contracting, so moving together as a single unit. They form this kind of cup shape, and then in response to light, they invert themselves. Think of like, they're like little like dome shapes.
Those like popper things?
Yeah, the popper things, yeah. So in response to light, they basically change from this like, you know, the popper, popping. They flip themselves inside out, basically, or outside in response to light.
So that's a group
It's a group of them together. Yeah,
that's so
as I mentioned, the coanoflagellates in their unicellular state have this sperm-like shape, but some of the coanoflagellates come together in larger groups. One of the ones that we study in the King Lab is called Salpingoiga rosetta, or S. rosetta, and it forms these rosette colonies. So it kind of looks like a little bouquet of flowers. It's really cool. They do it in response to a bacteria. So they eat this bacteria, and for some reason, this bacteria induces them to form this rosette colony. And the cool thing about the rosette colony and why we study it is because it forms very similar to what an early animal embryo would look like. So it's successive divisions from this initial starting cell, and then they stay together as a colony.
That's so cool. So it's like the more coanoflagellates are together, it's like the closer to an animal that collective group becomes.
Yeah, and we think they're at, we study them because we think they're at this cool transition where we think, you know, kind of resembles what an early animal would do, is that it has a part of its life maybe as this unicellular state and a part of its life maybe as this multicellular state.
It's like three kids in a trench coat becoming an adult. It's like a, like 10 coanoflagellates in a trench coat becomes an animal.
And this is why I have these weird emotional attachments. It's like, oh, look at you becoming a rosette.
World domination by coanoflagellates.
Coanos are cute. They would never do that.
This episode was produced by me, Celia Ford, with help from the team at Carry the One Radio. This episode was supported by the Office of University Development and Alumni Relations at UCSF. A big thank you to Carly Van Orstel, David Cabrell, Sama Ahmed, Janine Cuevas, and Judith Horn, and all the rest of our rad Patreon supporters. You can join them too, just head to patreon.com/carrytheone. If you give $3 or more, we will send you some great thank you gifts, like our special 10th anniversary stickers. But if $3 sounds a little steep, let us know what you think by leaving a comment or review, absolutely free of charge. You can find more episodes on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. We have lots of non-COVID-19 related science content if you need a little brain break from the news. But as it does, this virus has shaken up our schedule a bit, so we'll be extending Women's History Month into April. Why not? Time is fake now. So tune in next week for the next episode of Carry the One's Women in Science series. Stay healthy, stay sane, and as always, stay curious.